Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So you may have recently heard someone say the 30s are the new 20s. You may have even heard a 20-something insist people just start later these days, meaning careers. My next guest is pushing against that idea and offering 20-somethings advice for how to do the math right to make 20s the new 20s. Meg Jay is a clinical psychologist who specializes in 20-somethings. She's an assistant clinical professor at the University of Virginia and now author of The Defining Decade, Why Your 20s Matter, and How to Make the Most of Them Now. Perhaps you read her op-ed in the New York Times over the weekend about the downside to cohabitation before marriage. In fact, it was at the top of the most emailed list from the Times at the beginning of the week, so perhaps you even sent it around. We will talk about the so-called cohabitation effect and how to do the math to plan your life, whether you're in your 20s or not. Hello, Meg Jay. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Can you explain first present bias, which you talk about in the book, because we all have present bias. As you describe, people of all ages and walks of life discount the future. What is present bias, and why are 20-somethings especially prone to it?
Okay. Present bias is just what you said. It's what we call discounting the future. It's when we favor the rewards of today over the rewards of tomorrow. So we think, I want to do what feels good today, and I'll worry about tomorrow. This can be especially relevant for 20-somethings because their brains are still working on the part that thinks about the future and anticipates consequences. But these are the years to really wire your brain to learn how to anticipate what's going to come in the decades ahead.
And listeners, our phones are open for 20-somethings who want to talk to Dr. Meg Jay, author of The Defining Decade. We're talking about doing the math in your life and how you're planning to spend this decade. Does the present bias that Dr. Jay just described sound familiar to you? Are you being told to just have a good time, or you'll only be young once? What does that mean for your career or your relationships? How are you doing the math when it comes to your 20s? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And a little later in the segment, we'll get into that op-ed she wrote, adapted from her book on cohabitation before marriage and the downsides of cohabitation. And last call for the survey that we're taking on that, text LIVE to 30644 if you want to answer a few questions about marriage and living together. That's the subject of the conversation we will have with Meg Jay. Text LIVE to 30644. We'll text you back a little four-question survey to take, and we'll bring you the results in a few minutes within this conversation. Text LIVE to 30644. At one point in the book, Dr. Jay, you described making a timeline for a 26-year-old client, Rachel. She says she wants to be married at 40 and have her first kid at 45 and at some point get her law degree. So you start there and work backwards. Can you explain how that works, and what was Rachel thinking?
I think Rachel was thinking, I've heard 30 is the new 20. I think if I just wait and start my life later, it's somehow automatically going to be better. It's going to be different than what my parents did. I'm going to make different decisions. I'll marry smarter. I'll have a better career. I'll have had all my fun first, and then I can push everything into my 30s and 40s. But what 20-somethings who've heard these sort of messages don't realize is that when you get into your 30s and 40s, life is more stressful, and couples look at each other and they say, life isn't adding up. And I've seen the heartbreak that goes along with realizing that they can't have the careers or the families or the lives that they now realize they want.
Let's take a phone call. John in Smithtown, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
How you doing, Brian? Love the show.
Thank you.
I think that there's also a kind of, you were saying how the lives don't add up and stuff. I think that actually doesn't come from living in the present. I think that has to do with living in the future. You perceive what your life is going to be like instead of just living it. And when you start to, you know, it's expectations that hold you back. It's not living in the present that holds you back. You think you're going to have this bigger, grander life. And when you get there, it isn't that big and it isn't that grand, and you're disappointed.
Right. Well, you know what, John, you bring up a great point. And research on time has shown that people who are happiest and feel most satisfied with their lives, they balance present thinking and future thinking. And they do a little bit of past thinking so that they learn from their mistakes. But I think you bring up a great point of you've got to balance appreciating what you have, accepting what you have, living in the present, but also being mindful of where might I like to be 2, 3, 5, 10 years down the line.
John, thank you very much. Scott in Sussex County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Scott. Thanks a lot for calling in.
No problem. It's wonderful to get in touch. I usually try to call in and my phone dies or something. But my the point I'd like to make is I'm 22, and one thing that I find quite often is regardless of, you know, my ability or a 20-something's ability to push ahead, there's actually quite many social barriers that I run into with trying to get ahead and get a job. In fact, I've lived 3 different cities in the past 3 years. Since I moved out of my house at 18, and just the barriers that I come across with finding work and even having landlords that look at me as just a young person and someone that's going to cause trouble from the get-go causes an immense number of problems.
You know, Scott, I agree with you. I think part of, you know, I really did not write the defining decade to blame 20-somethings. The book is intended to empower 20-somethings and to tell 20-somethings and adults of all ages to say, let's stop dumbing down the 20s. Let's stop dumbing down 20-somethings. But I think it's disempowering to see 20-somethings as less than adults who can't have a good job and can't be responsible in an apartment. And I'm not surprised you're meeting those obstacles because I do think that's what happens when, as a culture, we don't take 20-something seriously.
I think as well, too, you know, I feel like I have a lot to offer. In certain positions, I'll see something, perhaps a job that I would normally apply for, and I can see that the person working it, in my own opinion, which might have its own bias, that I might be able to perform it better or that, you know, perhaps there's some way that I can, you know, I feel like I need to prove myself a little bit more. Which sometimes actually works against me when somebody's just looking for the average Joe and then I kind of look overqualified in terms of getting a job at least.
Right, right. I mean, I can see how that happens, and I think, again, it goes back to this idea that we have culturally that 20-somethings aren't grown-ups, that we don't really take them seriously. They can't take themselves seriously. I think it's time we all take 20-somethings more seriously and give ourselves and each other the opportunities.
Thank you for your call, Scott. Call us again. So, folks, unless not been paying attention to your television for the past week or so, you've heard about the new HBO show Girls about 20-somethings in New York. It's certainly not a documentary by any stretch, but the characters are going through a lot of what this book describes. And here is a clip from the premiere of 24-year-old Hannah getting a talk from her parents.
How can I phrase it? Well, we see how well you're doing at work, and you really seem to be figuring out what it is that you want. But it may be time for one final push.
What is a final push?
We're not going to be supporting you any longer.
See, I wasn't going to phrase it like that, Lorraine, the way you phrased it.
But I have no job.
No, you have an internship that you say is going to turn into a job.
I don't know when.
You graduated from college 2 years ago. We've been supporting you for 2 years, and that's enough.
Ooh, ow. Did you watch Girls?
Ouch. No, did I?
Yeah.
No, I didn't. I wish I had. It's been quite a week, but I very much plan to tune in.
And did that scene resonate with anything that you see your 20-somethings going through?
It absolutely does. Now is not an easy time to be a 20-something, especially with the economy as it is. So I think it's just so important that 20-somethings get the right information about how to start their lives and how to be financially independent and how to get going in their careers.
And how about the right time to be cut off, even if the father didn't want to put it that way, from your parents? Or
well,
for the parents, when is the right time? If your adult child in their 20s is staying home, is living at home and maybe doing an internship, maybe trying, maybe you don't think they're trying hard enough to get paid work. Maybe you don't think they're taking low enough paid work because they want to enter a career track. I mean, do you see a lot of families negotiating this?
Yes, and I think negotiating is the perfect word for it, because 20-somethings are a very diverse group, so people are living at home for a lot of different reasons among the ones who are living at home. So I think it is a negotiation, and you have to consider, why are they living at home? What's the arrangement? Are they contributing around the house? Are they contributing to expenses? Is there an end to this? Is there a timeline for how long this is going to last, or could this just slide into being a 4 or 5 year arrangement that gets in the way not just of, it sounds like, what the parents wanted, but also really what would make that 20-something happiest.
And there must be class issues here, too. People are in
Absolutely.
Such different situations.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Kelsey in Red Bank, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hey, how are you doing?
Thanks for calling.
I'm just calling. I'm 23. I graduated about a year ago. I've been looking for a job since the end of the summer, and I can't seem to really find anything. And everywhere I go and all the listings that I read, it says, you know, that they want 3-4 years of experience. And it's just, it's really disheartening because, you know, how am I supposed to get that needed experience if no one will even give me a chance, you know? And
right.
It's just, yes. It's been really difficult, and all my peers, they're having the same issues.
Absolutely. It's so disheartening, Kelsey, and I absolutely remember looking at ads and thinking, how am I supposed to get experience with no experience? My best advice for you is something I write about in the defining decade, is use your weak ties. Most jobs come from friends of friends of friends or contacts of contacts of contacts. And I know there's a lot of 20-somethings out there that are emailing and sending hundreds of resumes into cyberspace. This is not how 20-somethings are getting their jobs, especially right now. So use every possible person in your network, because oftentimes people will hire you without the experience if you're known to them somehow.
And what do you do if you don't say, like, have too many contacts? Because, you know, it's all about networking, it seems, these days.
Right.
But if you don't really have anyone to network with, then how are you supposed to go about it?
Well, you know, everybody has a network, and I think that's something that 20-somethings don't know enough about, and they haven't had enough experience in that. Everybody has a network, and I don't mean a network of your 10 best friends or even your family members. I mean all of your friends' networks and all of your family's networks, the really wide web that comes out from you. That's where new job leads, new information, even new people to date, that's where it comes from outside the inner circle. So I think you'd be surprised by how many contacts you had if you kind of get out there and talk and ask and email and ask for favors, just to see what you can do to broaden that circle.
Kelsey, I hope that helps. Thank you so much for calling. We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, we'll keep talking about relationships with Dr. Meg Jay. She's the author of The Defining Decade, Why Your 20s Matter and How to Make the Most of Them Now. And again, perhaps you read that op-ed in the New York Times over the weekend that she wrote about the downside to cohabiting before marriage. It was at the top of the most emailed list from the Times at the beginning of the week. We'll talk about the so-called cohabitation effect, and we're going to clear our lines of all the other calls that were coming in for Meg Jay and focus on this right now. So if you want to talk about cohabitation, what effect you think it had on your marriage, if you got married afterwards, maybe you're in your 20s and cohabiting right now, 212-433-WNYC. Anyone who read the article, especially if you're in your 20s, 212-433-9692. And we'll reveal the results of our text survey on cohabitation that we've been taking all morning. Stay with us. More now with Dr. Meg Jay. She's the author of The Defining Decade, Why Your 20s Matter and How to Make the Most of Them Now. We're talking about her piece, The Downside to Cohabitation Before Marriage, which ran in the Times this weekend, adapted from the book. Dr. Jay, were you surprised how widely your piece was shared?
No, I was not, actually. I wasn't, because it's one of the most dynamic, interesting topics of conversation I have with clients and students, so I wasn't surprised.
What is what you call the cohabitation effect, and why did you focus on its downside?
The cohabitation effect, that's not my term. It's from the research, but it's about the idea that in certain forms of cohabitation can lead to less relationship satisfaction and even relationship disillusion. I focused on the downside in the article and in the defining decade because I think it 20-somethings don't know enough about the potential downsides of cohabitation. They know the upsides, that it's convenient, it's fun, you get to spend more time with your partner, but a lot of them don't know the downsides, such as something that seems like a quick decision and you have a quick exit really can turn into quicksand.
Quicksand in what way? Because a lot of people say that you want the opportunity to see if you're compatible enough with somebody, that it's really kind of a very sensible thing before you get married.
Right, and I get that. But knowing that, you also need to know that when you combine bills and furniture and pets and friends, you're making it harder to get out of the relationship. So a lot of 20-somethings say, I'll try this out, it's a test, it's no big deal. But then they find 1 year slips into two or three, and the test really hasn't been passed. They don't really want to stay with their partner. It's just very hard to get out. And I have had countless clients sit in my office and say, I wasted my 20s living with somebody for 4 or 5 years who shouldn't have been around longer than a year.
Mm. And you do seem to be swimming against the tide of public opinion, because we've been doing this texting project this morning about living together in marriage. We got nearly 500 replies, 137 males and 198 females texted in. The average age was 35. And we asked about their living situation, and 35% of them are living together unmarried. 36% are living together married, so almost an even split. Mm-hmm. And we asked if, in general, people think it's a good idea to live together before getting married, and the answer was overwhelming. 85% of our respondents said yes, 15% said no. Now, this is, of course, not a scientific survey. It's not a random sample. It's people who chose to write us. But it was 500 people, average age in their 30s, a third of which are living together.
Right. Well, it's interesting, Brian, because I'm not swimming against the public opinion. I'm saying know the risks, know the benefits. And the Times piece that I wrote, I didn't say that I'm for or against cohabitation. Mm-hmm. I said I'm for people knowing the downsides, because that way, when you cohabitate, which I do assume the majority of Americans are going to do, I think upwards of 60 to almost 70% of marriages are preceded by cohabitation, that is going to turn out better for you if you're aware of the risks, because you could be more mindful and then kind of work against those when you're cohabitating with someone.
Our lines are completely full with people who want to talk about this. Joshua in Rockaway Beach, thank you for calling in.
How's it going, guys?
Good.
Hi,
what
Josh.
You cohabiting?
Hey.
Well, basically, I've been living with my girl for about a year and a half. Out of 2 years, we've been dating. This is my second cohabitation relationship. I had a bad one of 5 years previously. Like the doctor said, I was too young. I do agree with that. With your 20s, the integrity of your character, is, I don't think it's really set in stone. So it is easy to be dissuaded when you are close to somebody. But also, I think it makes you a stronger person. You know, I've gone through my first relationship basically catering to my girlfriend. And through that, I kind of found out what I really wanted and who I really was. So my second time around has been much better. And I believe in common law marriage. I believe that, you know, if you're with somebody long enough, you need a shred of paper or a signature to clarify your love, you know.
So you don't see your cohabitation currently as a test, which if you both pass it, you're going to get married, as opposed to you're just going to stay together however long?
No, we test each other every day. We love each other. We keep each other on our toes, you know? Both of us knows what we want out of life. And right now it looks like both of our paths are kind of straight and going parallel. So
uh-huh.
That's great.
Josh, that's great to hear, because what we know about cohabitation in terms of when it goes well or when both partners agree and have a mutual and clear commitment, if those are the conditions for cohabitation, you're just as likely as a couple who's never cohabitated to be to stay together happily, to not break up, to be satisfied. So that's really the key to cohabitation, is there a clear and mutual commitment? If not, that's where it gets messy. But Josh, I have a question for you. Did you feel like that previous 5-year cohabitation went on a bit longer than it should have?
Definitely, by about 2.5 years.
Exactly.
That was more of my problem. I was trying to correct something that it wasn't a problem, didn't need to be fixed. It was just basically me and her in denial about our paths in life, you know, and it just
exactly.
didn't work.
Right.
And so we did. We hung out for a little bit longer than we should have, but hopefully that'll be a mistake that I don't make twice.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, well, it doesn't sound like you are. Bye, Josh.
Karen in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Karen.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Great.
You sound like you're surprised you're on the air, but you called us.
I know. I just didn't think I'd get chosen, but I'm glad you did. Thanks for having me.
And?
Hi, Karen.
Hi.
So go ahead.
Well, I've been living with my boyfriend for almost 4 years. We've been together for 5. I'm 37 years old. And, you know, I sort of thought that this was about 20-somethings living together, cohabitating, so I'm not really sure if I got the concept right, but I can't imagine living with somebody in my 20s because it's just incredibly difficult to learn how to share. And I think, at least in my 20s, I was not very good at sharing. And the first couple years of living with my boyfriend were very, very difficult. We're very strong people. And sharing was just not something that really came to either one of us very easily. Thank goodness we've learned through very difficult times to share and to, give of ourselves. But it was a very difficult learning process for both of us. And, we don't plan on getting married, at least I don't. And I plan to be with him for the rest of my life. I hope I am. But marriage isn't really a priority. But
maybe the ability to share comes quickly if you live together sooner, and it's harder because, you know, if people have a whole decade of living on their own before they even try, I don't know, it's just an alternative hypothesis. Mm-hmm. Dr. Jay, what are you thinking as you listen to Karen?
You know, Brian, I was thinking a little bit of what you were thinking of, that yes, Karen, I think it's true that 20-somethings who live together can have a tough time sharing, but it's also a great time to learn. Their brains are going through their last critical period of growth, and they're being wired for the adults they're going to be. So I think one of the upsides of roommate situations, cohabitation situations in your 20s is learning how to navigate complex, difficult relationships, because that's what adulthood is all about, are really difficult relationships that you have to stick with.
Karen, good luck. Thank you very much for sharing the wisdom of your 30s hard-earned through your 20s. Alex in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Meg J. Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, how about you?
I'm doing well. All right, so basically I just wanted to ask the doctor if she had looked into cohabitation, not with a significant other, but with roommates, and how that affects your 20s and how that may affect cohabitation with a significant other later on in life. I mean, I know in New York City, no one in their 20s can afford to live alone. I know
sure.
from my friend, everybody's
sure.
got roommates, you know?
Yeah, right. it's a great question. Living with roommates, does it set you up to cohabit with a lover?
Uh-huh. That is a great question, Alex. We should have talked before I wrote my book. I think there's a lot of places you could take that. One is, I do think living with roommates does help prepare you for living with a partner, because you do have to share, as Karen was talking about, have to learn how to get along with people, which is not easy when you live together 24/7. I think roommates are also something really important to think about, not because of cohabitation, but because you spend so much time with them. And so a trap that I see 20-somethings falling into a lot is living with people and being surrounded by people who don't necessarily share their long-term vision or their long-term goals. And you can get really sort of stuck in the present of what's going on with me and my roommates all the time and not be able to think about where do I want my life to be in 5 years. So those are some of the risks and the benefits of those roommates.
Alex, great question. Good luck. Hannah Rosen of Slate wrote a rebuttal to your piece. She wrote about research from Bowling Green State University, which has found that the cohabitation effect, quote, has almost totally faded. We just can't detect it anymore. Are you familiar with Rosen's response or with that research?
Sure. Yes, I am. I am, and I discussed it, or I alluded to it in the piece. I mean, I think what Hannah Rosen is talking about are big population effects. That yes, the unfavorable link between cohabitation and divorce is on the decline. It's nearly disappearing, and I think that's great news. If you look at studies that are on smaller samples but can look more closely at what's going on with couples, we know that all cohabitation is not the same. It's not whether you cohabitate, it's how you cohabitate. So some couples are more at risk than others. So we know that serial cohabitators are at risk, couples where the partners have different levels of commitment, people who are testing the relationship. For those couples, they still are more likely to be less satisfied and maybe to eventually divorce down the line. That is still true for those sorts of couples.
And something perhaps has changed culturally now that Americans have been cohabiting for so long, because Rosen cited stats that nearly 60% of women aged 25 to 39 have lived with a partner, and that it is more successful now in general than when couples were cohabiting in the 80s. Does that ring true?
Absolutely, and I discussed that in the New York Times piece, too. I think some really great news that a Pew Research report put out a few years ago is that about two-thirds of Americans see cohabitation as a step toward commitment. And if you want to be happy in your relationship and have that relationship stay together, that needs to be the attitude. That's what sets people up for good relationships. It's where we have problems is when couples see it as a good way to test a relationship, or they don't discuss their commitment levels. Those are the couples who are at risk. The ones who see it as a commitment, they're okay.
We leave it there with Dr. Meg Jay, the author now of The Defining Decade, Why Your 20s Matter and How to Make the Most of Them Now. Great conversations. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks, Brian. I enjoyed it.
And listeners, if you want to see more of the details as we continue to crunch the number on this text survey that we've done on cohabiting, watch our webpage or our Twitter feed later today.